Blog Talk Radio.
Reason is our weapon of choice. Skeptics know that you do have a voice. Science, not so we'll be defying it. What we know, so it's best to apply it. Feed you information, deposits the knowledge, so you know ignorance is not an option. Welcome to the RSS feed with your host, Raina Rose. Skeptical superwoman, but in plain clothes. She ain't no Jane Doe, nor is she a day old. So the cobalt arguments, weakly molded like Play-Doh. Kicking false info like Kato, but it should be a J-O. To expand your mind like a transit line. Nothing is ever true, cause you think so. It's evident that you never win, cause the evidence you present is irrelevant in the present tense. It's reckless and negligent. Never ask questions or to think ignorance is good to relish it. So we spark debate, cause you know the truth is hard to take. Especially with so many falsehoods in these modern days. Ocean reality, we start to face. Shout out to the skeptics, my freak thinking. Deliver cow, missiles, I fire a heat seeker. And aim that you shoot or win the leg. You weak creatures, Christian Science Institute debate evolution. Elitists in the government that hate the revolution. Armchair activists who overstate their contribution to the movement, cause they say they have solutions. So it's best to listen and understand skepticism is the religion. And so we get a better vision of how the world works in what we call marvelous to make a better future. You know that it starts with us. Progressive thoughts, progressive talk, the sharing of ideas, the medicine we need. Another dose of the RSSD. Say what? Another dose of the RSSD.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Kim. We are, Raina should be on any minute now, and we just thank you all for tuning in to the RSSB, having a technical difficulty right now, and that should be situated shortly, but in the meantime, we just ask that you all be patient, and we should be starting up in about a minute or so, but in the meantime, you know, we want you to contemplate on environmental justice, what role has it played in your life, how much do you know about it, and, you know, give us some feedback. We're going to be opening up the chat room in a minute, and we'll be looking forward to speaking with you then. Again, our apologies for the delay, and for those of you who are listening, the Day of Solidarity is tomorrow. So hopefully, there's an event happening in your area. But if not, again, you can put together an event yourself. Even if it's just a couple of people getting together for a cup of coffee. Very simple. And we encourage all to participate in some capacity. And thank you guys for being patient. As you can tell, I'm a little out of breath. But it's because I was running. So just bear with us. We will have Raina here shortly. And we can start our discussion about environmental justice. And, again, the role that it plays in your life, the history of it. And this is just one show of many in which we will be discussing this extremely, extremely important issue. You know, Raina's been very excited about it all week, and she has a lot of information to bring you guys. So, you know, just bear with us for a second, of course, and we will go from here and get you guys educated on this, you know, matter. And again, if you have something to contribute to the conversation, please feel free to call in. Feel free to Skype in. You should be able to Skype in. You see the big blue S at the top during the broadcast here. You can Skype, and we'll bring you on board and talk to you about these issues here. So just bear with me. I think I have this technical issue under control now. Let me see. Hold on. And we're getting there. I apologize. Because I hate when this happens. This has happened a couple of times in the past. And
we met and it resolved. So just bear with us. And the only reason why you can hear me is because I dial into the master control system. All right, it's taking its time here, but we'll get it set up shortly. So in the meantime, like I said, for those, for the Day of Solidarity, we just ask that you all, you know, just participate in some way, send us your pictures and your testimonials. We now have Raina on the line. Thank you, Raina.
No problem. hey, everybody. It's Raina, and this is the RSS feed. Today's subject is environmental justice. Been looking forward to doing this one for a while. Got a lot of information to talk about today. Probably won't get it to even half of it, but we'll have future shows on it. Hopefully some awesome guests in the future as well. Going to try to reach out to some people. But you're still with me, Kim, right? Hello? Kim?
Say that again.
Okay, I just want to make sure you're still with me. Okay, the number, if you want to call in, just so to remind you all, is 310-982-4273. And to begin with, we're kind of just going to do an overview today. I'm not giving, you know, every single account of everything that's going on in environmental justice. I won't be able to get into all of the governmental and policy issues today. I just kind of want to give you an overview, kind of, you know, a big picture and an idea of what environmental justice is so you can go and do your own research. But I'll start off by saying that, by giving you really the definition of environmental justice, which per the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, or national origin, or income with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. And so environmental justice, in a sense, really comes out of environmentalism, although it is somewhat more focused in a sense on the intersection of environmental issues with social justice, with looking at how populations are affected, based on socioeconomic status and race. And some people are particularly focused on the aspect of race. And so you have also environmental racism that is looked at or combated by a lot of people within the environmental justice movement. And environmental racism itself, you know, specifically refers to geographic relationships between environmental degradation and low-income or minority communities. And so the idea is that some people are disproportionately affected by certain environmental issues based solely on their race. They're solely on their race and income. And race, in a sense, is place when you think about it, because, black people, generally speaking, do not have access to education, to certain economic opportunities. And so, just like how some people can kind of identify what part of the country you come from based upon, you know, your name, your risk, in a sense, for being affected by these population, environmental problems is closely related to race in some sense. Environmental justice is also very closely related to the fields of bioethics, toxicology, policy, and social justice, among other things, as I've already said. And, there, just like there are disparities in health, you know, there are these categories that make you more at risk for exposure to air pollution, for example, water pollution, lead paint poisoning, and a whole host of other types of chemical exposures. And so to kind of understand what I'm talking about when I talk about exposures and stuff, it's kind of complicated, and without getting into giving you all an entire course on toxicology, I'm going to try my best to give you guys an idea of what sorts of things one needs to understand in order to think about environmental justice in an intelligent way. And we'll start off with talking about what toxicology is. So toxicology is it's the field of science which deals with looking at poisonous or hazardous substances. And in the field, you determine what types of chemicals and chemical exposures pose a risk, and also their mechanisms and the relationship between dose and response, and all these sorts of things. Really important to this for the purposes of our discussion is understanding risk assessment. Because just because something is a toxic substance does not necessarily mean that it poses a huge risk for every population at a particular dose or in a particular exposure setting. I'll paraphrase Paracelsus, who was a physician, that all substances are essentially poisons depending on the dose. And if you don't believe me, you can Google water intoxication or water poisoning. For those of you that don't know, you can take in way too much water. Some things that are good for you are not so good for you at, you know, a higher dose.
As a matter of fact, there's an example for that. There was a contest, a radio station had a contest as to who could drink the most water, and the young man that won the contest ended up dying.
Yes. And I think actually it's been more than one contest that I've read about that's like that. So when you evaluate substances for toxicity, there's like a number of things that you need to take into account. The first is sort of the strength between the substance of the relationship, rather, between the substance and the proposed effect. And this relationship has to be specific. If you know the substance is generally, if you've seen the substance induce a rash, the next time that you see that substance given in the same exposure, it shouldn't cause vomiting. You know what I mean? With the same dose of the same exposure. So although there are some differences sometimes in idiosyncratic responses, allergic reactions, tolerance, you know, and a whole host of other things that I'm not going to discuss because this is not a toxicology course. The relationship has to be strong, and it has to be specific in order to establish, you know, causation. Then the consistency of the relationship it should be consistent, and the consistency of the relationship has to be evaluated. So again, if it happened that, you know, you gave the dose, you put the chemical on the skin at a particular dose, every time you put it on that particular part of the skin, you should see the same response or a similar response. And then there's the strength of the dose response. So it should vary by dose. So if I give you, like, you know, a quarter of a gram, it should be a lot different than, you know, 1,000 grams, you know. And I'm just being very general right now because I don't want to confuse anybody, and I don't want to, you know, get ahead of anybody who hasn't really had a science course. But or, you know, maybe had one very long, a long time ago. But also you have to evaluate the temporal sequence. So your effect cannot precede your cause. And this one's important in not just in a toxicology sense, but it's important to understand in medicine as well. A lot of people sometimes confuse in medicine or, you know, taking a large quantity of vitamin C while they're sick with getting better. And there's actually no relationship that can be established scientifically between vitamin C and taking a large acute dose of vitamin C and getting better. So it doesn't work like that. I know that's the conventional wisdom, but generally speaking, when you're already having symptoms, you're already on your way towards recovery, generally speaking, by the time you have the symptoms. But it's good to have vitamin C, so I'm not going to discourage you guys to drink your orange juice when you're sick, because you need lots of fluids. But and then you also need a plausible mechanism. So and you have to consider in this what is known about biology and in the realm of science. So you're not going to have something that completely contradicts what we know about physiology. You know, you also and I'll also add to this is you have to take into account the route of exposure. Now, I don't know, we don't have any callers, and I would like to ask a caller why we should maybe take into account the route of exposure, because I think it's a very, I think most people, if they think about it, it'll make sense. Do you know, Kim, why you have to take into account route of exposure? I'm sure you do, Kim, actually.
Yeah, we've talked about this a little bit, but,
yeah.
You know, it's extremely important that people go out and do the research and understand, you know, again, you know, how this does affect them. It affects you directly, you know, and it's not an indirect effect. It can be an indirect means of how it affects you. But, you know, all of this, you know, affects you, and it's just important for people to go out and to understand. And we're giving you some basic information, but this is just so that we can kind of pique your interest. Pique your interest enough for you to go out there, and everyone can play a part from the inner city, urban areas, you know, the metropolitan areas out to the, you know, suburbs and the rural areas. We all play a part. We all drink this water. We all breathe this air. We all eat these foods. You know, Raina mentioned a little bit earlier about lead poisoning, and in particular, I would like to point to the people in the inner cities, you know, the urban areas, whereas that was a problem, you know, several years ago, and many people are still suffering the effects from the lead poisoning, from the lead paint. You know, the children were eating the paint chips and, you know, getting sick. So this does affect you. It really does.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, Kim's like, you don't have to get ahead of me, man. No. In any case, we haven't gotten to the leg yet. It's okay. But no, Kim is correct. You know, route of exposure and dose and frequency, you know, all of these things factor into the toxic response. Some chemicals you bioaccumulate. Some you can't eliminate easily. Some hang around for years. You know, and the way that you are exposed to them matters too, because, for example, things that you inhale, they go directly into the bloodstream, you know, or if they're small enough, rather, and they're gaseous, they can be transferred directly into the bloodstream, you know, via, you know, the respiratory system. Some things like particulate matter in smoke, those get trapped. Generally speaking, within the alveoli of the lungs, and depending upon how large those particles are, some end up in the upper respiratory tract, and some end up in the lower. But the smaller they are, the further they can get into your respiratory system and cause a lot of damage. You know, There's things that sometimes by themselves don't cause any direct harm, but combined with other chemicals or other exposures can be very serious. One example is photosensitivity. Some people are photosensitive anyway, but some people, some chemicals, if you're exposed on your skin, they combined with light can cause serious damage to your skin, serious damage to your health, So these things are very important to understand.
Another example that I could give is the asbestos. There are a lot of lawsuits behind that because they were using that in homes and buildings, not only apartment buildings, but, business buildings and all of the commercial buildings.
Yeah, a lot of places. There are some older schools that actually still have asbestos in them, and teachers, some teachers, now the teachers may not have a problem if they've worked there a year or 2 years or 3 years, but there are some teachers that have worked in some of these older schools that still have problems with asbestos for over 20 years. And, of course, the risk of asbestos exposure is mesothelioma, very serious respiratory condition. And there are other forms of occupational exposures that are important as well. But we're not really so much talking about occupational exposure because occupational exposure and environmental justice in some ways can be linked, but in other ways not necessarily. But I kind of wanted to go give a little bit of history before we got too deep into specific instances of environmental justice or events in environmental justice history, kind of just to give you guys a little bit of context, for what we're talking about. And so, as I said, I gave you some considerations that you should, keep in mind. And there's a whole spectrum of undesirable effects and species differences. Something that is poisonous to a rat may not be poisonous to a human being. And there are, again, those response relationships to keep in mind. There has not yet been any demonstration of a chemical that, that does not have a threshold for toxic response. There are some chemicals that are toxic that when given in small quantities are beneficial, selenium, for example, is one. It's in vitamins. It's sold, I think it's a particular selling point for the geriatric vitamins. But selenium in large enough quantities is a toxicant, and it's pretty nasty. But there actually are some studies that are done that show that there's a population, I should say, in the Seychelles Islands of people who have high doses of selenium in their diets, and they also eat a lot of fish. And if you know anything about fish, if you know anything about fish, you know that there are a lot of fish species that are particularly high in levels of mercury. It's usually the ones that are higher up the food chain. So the higher up the food chain you go, like swordfish, sharks, they bioaccumulate more mercury. And so in the population of the Seychelles Islands, they have this, they consume a lot of fish, and a lot of the fish has mercury, but they also have higher levels of selenium, and they've actually found that the selenium actually has a beneficial effect in protecting unborn children from birth defects related to mercury exposure. So it just goes to show you that it's not a simple process, just talking about and discussing toxicology. It's very complicated, and there are sometimes things that are going on within toxicology that are not completely intuitive. And I think and this is one of the reasons why on my blog, when I talked about environmental justice, I said that I think that this is a very good area for skeptics like myself to get into, because it allows us to use our critical thinking skills and our interest in science and other issues to dissect this information and kind of get a more clear picture of what's happening. Because it's very easy to get emotional about this type of stuff and think, oh, well, if it's bad, it's bad all the time, and it's bad over here, it's bad over there, it's bad at this amount, it's bad at that amount. Well, that could be true, you know, but maybe it's not always true, you know. And I use the word toxicant, and I should probably tell you that there are different ways to classify toxic substances based on their effects and their mechanisms of action. But toxin is the term that's generally given to naturally occurring biologically produced toxic substances. And those would be mostly plant-based, like curare is an example of a plant-based toxin, and that's used, by certain native populations in hunting and killing prey animals that upon which they prey. And then there's those that are not, that do not occur naturally or biologically, but are the products, the toxic, the products of man-made activities or anthropomorphic activities. And those are called toxicants, but also we use the term toxicants to describe naturally occurring but not biologically produced and not necessarily man-made toxic substances like mercury and arsenic, selenium, and those sorts of things. And TCDD, which we'll talk about in a second, which is man-made but also naturally occurring at the same time. So, and there are other substances that are also man-made and also naturally occurring, like polycyclic hydrocarbons, which is actually one of the things that I used to study. I just kind of want to give a little bit of history on toxicology, because I think it's really interesting. I kind of wanted to give you guys definitions, so I'm sorry if it feels like I'm going backwards, but I wanted to give you guys definitions and I wanted to give you history. So, people were studying toxicology like a long time before it was a field necessarily. I know you guys have probably heard about hemlock. You've heard of hemlock, right, Kim?
Yes, ma'am. I've heard of hemlock before.
So,
there are a lot of running jokes about it as well. Go ahead.
Yeah. hemlock was actually the poison that was given to Socrates. Here's another interesting thing that I learned when I was learning about toxicology. I don't know if you know this, Kim. I like Italian food, and there's actually a book that was written called The Philosopher's Cookbook, I think. And in The Philosopher's Cookbook, they talk about the history sort of Italian food. And Greek food. And do you know, for a very long time in Europe, tomatoes were not used in a lot of those dishes that we now associate with, tomatoes and tomato sauces. And the reason is because tomato is related to nightshade. And so for a very long time, tomatoes were thought to be poisonous.
Interesting. I read something not too long ago about the nightshade vegetables and all of that. And, with my condition, I'm not supposed to touch any of those. And I love me some tomatoes, but I did not know that.
Yeah. So I know that's just a weird thing. I'm sorry. I'm geeking out. It's my thing. But, there are some other incidents too. Just another thing to point out that I find interesting is I remember when I was in school learning about Rome, and Romans had a particular love of wine. And but Roman wine was not like wine that we drink today. It was bitter. It was pretty disgusting by our standards. And you know, one of the things that they did in Rome was they added lead, or they drank from leaded cups. And the funny thing is that when I was in school, we never learned that the Romans actually knew that lead was poisonous. They did, and they did not think that it was bad in very large in very small doses. Of course, it is bad. We know this now, particularly for children. Adults don't tend to absorb as much of the lead that they ingest as children do. Children absorb quite a significant, you know, portion of what they ingest. But yeah, they actually knew that they were poisoning themselves, but they didn't seem to have a problem with
wow.
it. And another thing that some of you might find interesting, I don't know. I can't gauge it because I'm a nerd, but some of you might, if you're familiar with the story of Alice in Wonderland, everybody knows the Mad Hatter.
Yes.
Everybody knows the Mad Hatter. And the Mad Hatter is not just mad because he's in Wonderland. Wonderland is a mad place. It's crazy. But it's not just because he was in Wonderland. He's mad because it's actually a reference to the hat manufacturing process and the way that they had to treat the felt to make the hats. They used mercury to treat the felt. And so workers had experienced neurotoxicity. And so the Mad Hatter is a reference to that that history. So I just thought I would say that because I find these things interesting. I don't know.
That's all right. Maybe. That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I find these things interesting. But in any case, there's some important things. There's some other important things too, like in industrialization. When industrialization happened, it started us down the path to really looking at, you know, the substances that are around us and the substances that we create and, you know, the byproducts of the things that we create. In Europe, for example, one of the first things that they noticed during the industrial period is that chimney sweeps had a particular risk for certain types of cancers. And that is because when you combust things, the leftover components include things like polycyclic hydrocarbons. And those chemicals, or those compounds, rather, are very toxic. They work through a variety of mechanisms, and only because I don't want to confuse anybody or talk over anybody's head, because if you get me started on this stuff, you guys will start rolling your eyes. I promise you. But I don't want to speak in jargon, and I have a tendency to do that when I start talking about these things. So I'm purposefully slowing myself down and trying to speak more generally. And we'll get more into the science itself in later episodes, but I don't want to lose anybody. So these compounds are carcinogens. And they're everywhere, and it's not just like when you combust, you know, things for the purposes of, manufacturing. It's, you know, the cigarettes that you smoke. So even if you took out any number of the additives that are in the cigarettes themselves, you still are combusting that tobacco and that paper, and in the process, you're creating smoke, which contains these products, and ash, which contains these products. So this is why I do not advocate smoking, and I rather detest smoking, because when you smoke, you're not just exposing yourself, you're exposing other people to these things, and so that's why
exactly
I don't like
that secondhand smoke. That secondhand smoke, my understanding, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding, secondhand smoke is even more dangerous than the direct. And I may be wrong, but, I mean, I remember reading that somewhere.
I remember reading that myself somewhere once. I don't know. I think in some sense it can be, and in other ways not so much. I think it really just depends. But we'll get into that another time. But you know, I just wanted to point that out because I know a lot of people who believe that by smoking quote unquote more natural things, that they are putting themselves at less risk for, you know, lung cancer and other things, but you're still smoking. And if you smoke enough, you still will put yourself at risk. And, of course, all of us have different genetics, which means that all of us have different risks, you know, when we get exposed. So That's just one example. And then, of course, in the 1940s, we started to use DDT and other organic pesticides and to increase our food production and reduce insect-borne disease. And I have to say this because I know a lot of people out here are really big advocates for organic food, and while I don't have an issue with organic food, I think that some of them make the mistake of saying that, you know, all pesticides are bad and we don't need them and all of these other things. But when you produce food on a massive level, in terms of food security, you have to in some sense, use some pesticides, some fungicides, some herbicides, because there are a lot of foodborne illnesses that, you know, come from insects and fungi and all kinds of things. And, you know, I can talk about that on another show. but I just wanted to throw that in there. And so some of those things, actually, we know now, of course, that DDT is extremely toxic and we don't use it. And there are other chemicals that we no longer use as well. And some of them are actually synthetic, and some of the synthetic pesticides are actually better than the former organic pesticides because they don't have the same toxic effects on human beings or even on the environment in some cases. So something to keep in mind. And actually 1947 was the first year when there was legislation that made it so that things that were neither food nor drugs had to be proven safe and effective. That was 1947. And I forget the name of that act. I forget the name of the act, but I'll get it for you guys. And then, of course, you had World War II and uranium enrichment. And a lot of the uranium, of course, is in our that we mine is in our Southwest. And if you know anything about the Southwest, you know that there are a number of Native tribes down there, and one of the largest reservations is actually the Navajo Reservation. Lots of land, and lots of it poisoned by the runoff from uranium enrichment and mines that were not properly sealed. There's a really good documentary on it called Return of the Navajo Boy. Very good documentary, and brought a lot of attention to these environmental issues that affect Native Americans in this country. But it's not over. They're still fighting down there to get those lands cleaned up and to get proper health care services to people who've been affected. Lots of different types of cancers, lots of birth defects and other things related to radiation sickness, radiation poisoning, you know, and what have you. Very, very sad situation. In 1962, Silent Spring was released, that actually having to do with a lot of those pesticides that I mentioned before. And then, of course, you know, we had gone to Vietnam, and there we used Agent Orange, and we found out later the contaminant in Agent Orange that caused a condition that we saw earlier that we had named chick edema factor. It was basically chickens were wasting away. They wouldn't eat. They were very, very, very thin, very small. And TCD is extremely toxic to human beings. TCDD is one of those chemicals that, again, that I said that is both naturally produced and a byproduct of human activities. And of course, Love Canal. Now, Love Canal was a big one. Love Canal was it was a site where hazardous waste and other things were dumped. And I'm pretty sure that Love Canal is still pretty toxic, if I'm not mistaken. It's actually a neighborhood near Niagara Falls. And that really kind of brings me to, you know, the quote-unquote beginning of the environmental justice movement. And for some people, that really begins with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so the father of the environmental justice movement, as he's sometimes called, is Robert Bullard. And Mr. Bullard wrote a book in the 1990s based on a case that he was involved in. In the 1960s, the book was called Dumping in Dixie. And the research that he did for the book was a part of a class action lawsuit that his wife was involved in as an attorney. And it was against the city of Houston, the state of Texas, and Browning Ferris Industries, which is a waste management company. The company was actually trying to build a dump site in a suburban middle-class neighborhood where over 82% of the single-family homeowners were black. And the lawsuit was the first in the United States charging environmental discrimination in a waste facility location under the Civil Rights Act. And so that really was, in some sense, like the start of the understanding of how environmental issues and toxicity affects people based on race and income or socioeconomic status. So do we have any callers, Kim?
Actually, we just had a Skype caller just come in. Let's bring them in. Chris Grizzle. Chris, are you there?
Yes, hello. How's everyone doing today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I usually call in and listen. I came into the call a little bit late. So can you guys fill me in on what you guys were talking about today so far?
Yeah, so we've been talking about environmental justice. I've been kind of giving a general idea of what toxicology is and sort of what goes into risk assessment a little bit. And we just got around to, you know, sort of talking about the start of what we have come to know as the environmental justice movement. And we were just talking about it, the one of the first, or the first, rather, lawsuit that was brought under the Civil Rights Act against a company that wanted to build a dump site in a middle class black neighborhood in the 1960s.
All right. Can you guys explain to me a little bit better what exactly environmental justice is?
Okay, so environmental justice is really about advocating for the fair treatment of people regardless of race and color and national origin with respect to how environmental laws and regulations affect them.
Okay. So it has to do not so much with the actual environment, like trees and fresh water.
It does. But it also concerns itself with how those issues impact the individuals of a particular area. So it basically, some people are more vulnerable to certain types of exposure to chemicals in industry based upon where they live. And where they live is generally tied to their race and their socioeconomic status. So there are some people who, for example, will say, not in my neighborhood. Well, not in your neighborhood means it has to go in somebody's neighborhood. So environmental
right.
justice is interested in determining whose neighborhood and how those people are affected and how we can minimize adverse effects for them and really find a way to be fair to them, because a lot of these people are disenfranchised or ostracized from, you know, the ability to exert political influence.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Yeah, all right. I get it. I understand a little bit better.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. All right. Okay, now I feel like I can listen to you guys and understand a little bit better. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll just go back on hold for a little bit, and then later on, maybe if I want to chime in on something else, I'll go ahead and jump right in if you guys will take my call.
Yeah.
Yes, Chris.
Okay.
Thank you. And I'm placing you back on hold. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate
it. Thank you, guys. Okay.
Thank you. So that was sort of the beginning of the environmental justice movement. And so, since there have been a number of other incidents, we were talking about lead exposure, for example, and, lead exposure is a major one, because while lead, lead from lead paint and lead in lead products and what have you, is not necessarily an issue that always affected blacks disproportionately. When it was found that lead was potentially harmful, black people and lower income people did not necessarily have the means to rid themselves of lead or the education to know how, detrimental exposure to lead was to them and their children. And so a lot of these, even today, in a lot of lower income neighborhoods, you can find, leaded paint. And you're not usually going to find it on the walls. It's usually not on the walls. It's going to be on the windowsills,
exactly.
Or on the frames, like the door frames and things like that.
Right.
But there are other places you can find lead too. But children are very tactile, and they want to put everything in their mouth. This is how they learn about the world. So children are particularly vulnerable to, being exposed to lead and a host of other things, just because
right.
they have this tendency to want to explore. So,
and in some cases, these children, they see that paint as food, unfortunately, because in some cases, that's all that's available. I mean, it hurts my stomach, but.
I was going to say, and lead is sweet. it's sweet. It has a sweet
taste.
You know, there are children who not knowing how harmful this is, will put it in their mouth because it's sweet, you know? I mean,
exactly.
I say that, guys, I don't know that it's sweet. Like, I don't go around, like, tasting lead, but.
Yeah, I'm not going to use myself as a guinea pig, but, you know, that's what I read, that it was sweet. So, but we have Sheila Bob. Skyping in. Let's bring Sheila Bob to the conversation. Sheila Bob, are you there?
Hi.
Oh, Lord.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
How are you guys?
We're fine.
My mom, hello?
All right. I think we're experiencing some technical difficulties. Let's see.
No, I don't think it's technical difficulties. I think it's trolling.
Right. We have another one here, Mr. Jeeves. Yeah, let's see what Mr. Jeeves has called the show before, but let's see. Mr. Jeeves, you
Hello,
are
ladies.
On the line.
How are you ladies
Hello.
Doing today?
We're doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm just listening to you guys talk about the problems in the urban developments, and I want to know, what is your thoughts on food deserts?
On food deserts, you know, that's sort of a different issue from environmental justice to an extent, but certainly.
Why are there no gardens?
And this is,
though, I mean, you guys, there's nothing but convenience stores and fast food joints around every corner, but there's lots of plots of land. Everybody has backyards, just about. Why aren't there gardens everywhere where fresh fruit and vegetables are grown? By the people
really
in their
depends.
Own community.
Well, that really depends on where you live, too. And some neighborhoods, no, there are not backyards, and particularly in urban settings.
But there's
you know, sometimes.
It's
there
like
are,
at what point?
Are,
what point do we stop and ask people? Listen, when are you going to get off your ass and take care of yourself?
Okay.
I mean,
and
would you
and
sit
under,
in the middle
is,
of the Sahara and not kill the gazelle?
But again, we're talking about environmental justice. These people do not, in many cases, have a choice when they decide to put a waste dump in the middle of their environment. They didn't have a choice when they were selling leaded paint as the standard. They were trying
they
to paint their homes. Now, in regards to what you're saying about, you know, people starting gardens and having urban gardens, this is starting to become more of a trend, and more people are starting to put them, you know, in their neighborhoods. But again, it takes money, it takes education, and, you know, again, we can get out there and we can teach people how to do some of these things. No one is arguing that.
And also, Kim, you know, you can want to plant, but that doesn't mean where you're planting is a safe place to grow food.
Exactly.
Why would it not be a safe place to grow food?
Because there are environmental issues.
Are you saying it's unsafe for
account.
People to go out in their own neighborhoods?
There are some neighborhoods that are toxic, yes.
Exactly.
There are
Why
some neighborhoods
you purposely
where you
live
cannot
in a toxic
food.
Zone, though?
You don't have. They don't have the choice. It's not that they chose to live there.
What do you
it's
mean
that,
they don't have the
that,
choice?
They don't have the choice. Do you have you?
How
okay.
how can somebody
first,
not
first
have
well.
A choice?
Yes, there's lots of ways. For one, you
we're talking about America,
in,
right?
Yes, we are talking about America, and we're and unfortunately, you seem not to understand the politics of you know socioeconomic status in this country and how people in the lower classes are ostracized from power. They don't.
And
have
I know
the
numerous success stories where somebody picked up their life with just a backpack on their back,
and those
moved
are
across the country,
those
and
are individual
and
situations.
Empire, like,
that is not in that case. That is
not
an indication.
Go ahead, Brian. I mean, what they don't seem to understand is not everybody is privileged. Not everybody has those opportunities. Some people, that is all they can afford. That's where they live. And again, they don't have a choice when somebody, certain entities, if you will, decide to come in and put a dump there or dump nuclear waste. It can be any number of issues.
And then there are issues related to education, economic opportunity. you know, and what have you. So you cannot just say that it's a matter of simple responsibility. You can want to take responsibility. You can want to plant the garden, but the soil is toxic.
And
you know?
you need the zoning permit. Yeah, we invite Mr. Jeeves out to any of our organizations so that he can put together a program, and we'll assist you, Mr. Jeeves, into going into the urban areas and helping everyone to plant gardens, you know, including getting the EPA reports and everything so that we can ensure that it's not a toxic area. And if it happens to be a toxic area, Mr. Jeeves will let you lead the way to the protest so that we can demand that they come in and clean up that environment. Since you're so concerned, please come in and help us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so getting back to environmental justice, I was, before he, you know, started to try to go off into his little, you know, privilege rant about how black people and lower income people need to take responsibility for their lives and, you know, completely divorced from the fact that these people are systematically, you know, ostracized from power and systematically left out of these discussions. I was going to add that the food deserts are another factor that is sort of related to the idea of environmental justice, because nutrition has a lot to do with how exposure affects an individual. Children that are particularly malnourished are much more vulnerable to lead paint poisoning and other types of poisoning than children who are well nourished. And particularly when you're talking about things like developmental neurotoxicity, which is one of the risks. For purposes of our discussion in my personal interest in my field is the developmental neurotoxicity associated with these type of exposures. Because, you know, developmental disorders and behavioral problems and what have you that are associated, you know, with these early insults, they are a major factor in terms of how money gets designated for health and education. We spend a lot of money on trying to remediate some of these effects, and if we could, you know, find nutritional supplements or ways to kind of combat these things earlier on, we may not have to spend so much money on trying to isolate these children or medicate these children later, you know? So, are you still there, Kim? Hello? I guess Kim is on the other line or something. Okay. So... yeah, so getting back to the subject at hand, we are talking about environmental justice, guys, and if you guys want to call in and not rant about people taking personal responsibility, the number is 310-982-4273. Hello?
I would like to say something. Yes, I'd like to say something.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I would just like to say that I'm very appreciative of the way that last caller was handled in terms of the things that he was saying, because you're absolutely right. There's no sense in ranting and raving. There are two sides to this issue, well, more than two sides, but there are lots of sides to this issue. And, you know, the point of the matter is if you're going to complain about what's happening in the urban communities or why society has to be concentrate so much effort, energy, and even allocate funds to take care of these issues, then get out there, look into the matter, see all sides of it, and do something about it yourself instead of complaining about it. I mean, it's here. It's not going to go away by just being swept under the rug. And it's clearly an issue where we're pitting white against black always. And that there's nothing that's going to come out of that unless there's understanding on all sides. That's my point.
Well, thank you for your point. Your very passionate point.
Right.
Yeah,
yes,
I am.
Very appreciate.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I was also going to say that, we've talked about urban communities, but this is not something that necessarily only affects urban communities. This also affects rural communities. For example, in the Appalachian Mountains, there's a lot of coal mining and drilling for other types of resources. And these communities are generally very poor communities, very, uneducated communities. And they're very dependent on the very same industry that poisons their water and poisons their land. These people also need to be discussed and helped by the environmental justice movement. You have people who are, for example, particularly with the mountaintop removal style of coal mining, you cover vast areas of land with, this debris and soot and these a lot of naturally occurring, substances and metals that are poisonous when absorbed into aquifers. The aquifer ends up in the, is where the water is under the ground and eventually ends up in well water. These chemicals sometimes are immunosuppressive. And so you have some people who, in addition to having, respiratory disorders, respiratory cancers, they also have depressed immune systems from drinking
exactly.
water contaminated from, this mountaintop removal drilling and such. There's a nice little piece that was done by Vice Magazine on YouTube that you can find where, it's only about 15 minutes long, but it's pretty compelling. There was a man, he's on, I think, something like 30 medications a day. He has terminal cancer, and he has two children, and he worked in mining for most of his life. Now, mining is actually a very lucrative, career for somebody who's in these mountains. I mean, there's no other job you can get up there that makes, $17 or $20 an hour, particularly fresh out of high school. So these men go into these fields and they work, 10, 20 years or so until they can't work anymore. But by then they have black lung disease from, inhaling the dust from, the coal mining. And then they go home to families with kids. The same guy had two children who were who take antibiotics. Nearly every day, and they can't stop taking the antibiotics because they get infections because they have depressed immune systems from drinking water that's been contaminated. And this sort of thing goes on all over the world. This isn't an American problem. This is a problem in China, where you have issues with nickel and other metals that are inhaled and contaminating water supplies. They also have a huge issue with smog and air pollution in China. That was one of the major complaints of a lot of the athletes in the Summer Olympics there. That it was very hard. It was that much harder to to breathe and to perform because they were in such a polluted environment. you know, and related to air pollution, I mean, there are statistics that say that I think up to 11% or more of the population lives near a freeway. And, of course, that represents another possible, you know, risk for certain types of, you know, exposures and things. In the past, it's particularly interesting because, you know, we have this, you know, most of us don't think about it when we go to the pump, you know, about leaded and unleaded gasoline because we don't have the option of leaded gasoline anymore. But there was once a time where leaded gasoline was the standard, and it was particularly detrimental to the environment. And there's all sorts of things. I mean, leaded ammunition in the environment can poison water, can poison animals. Sometimes birds will eat leftover, you know, little bits of metal from the ammunition. They can be poisoned. You know, leaded fishing lures, you know, those can sit in water, you know, in the lakes. And, you know, one or two by themselves don't have any major effect, but, you know, several given time, you know, can poison an entire water supply. So, you know, there's, and going back to what I was saying about the 11% of the U.S. population living within 100 meters of a four-lane highway. That's actually pretty shocking, you know? Like, you don't think about it when you're on the highway, you know? But there are people on the other side of those dividers, you know, of those walls, you know? There are people that live near those roads. You know, and you don't always think about it. And you yourself may live near one of those, and you might have a tree line or, you know, a mm-hmm. wall that kind of blocks out the sound. But
exactly. And when they did in Atlanta for the Olympics in Atlanta, they built the walls. They built the walls
yeah.
all around the perimeter, which is the 285 in Atlanta, and they
okay.
built walls to basically shield visitors from having to see some of the urban areas, and also it's interesting, but I mean it happens in quite a few cities.
Right, absolutely. And although this and what I'm about to tell you is still being researched. I'll tell you the first thing that's not necessarily contested, and then I'll tell you something that it needs to be further researched. But there are epidemiological studies that look at exposure of mothers, you know, pregnant mothers, in some of these urban areas that are at, you know, high risk of being exposed to air pollution or particulate matter, you know, exposure. And in one study, they had the women wear these backpacks that sampled the air. So they had, you know, the levels that they had recorded, you know, in other observations, and then they had the levels that each individual woman in the study kind of had near their house. And this was done in Manhattan. And they had another cohort, which was actually in a European city, and I can't remember the name of the city off the top of my head. But what's interesting about these two populations is the European population actually had somewhat of an artificially higher exposure to this particulate matter and this smoke and air pollution because it was a very industrial town. So they had a lot of plants, and Manhattan has a lot of air pollution as well, but not nearly as much as this particular town, okay? So, but when they looked at the African-American and Latino population versus this white population, they found that there was as much as a 5-point deficit in IQ when the children reached So I guess when the children were between ages 5 and 7, if I recall the study correctly. And a five point difference in IQ is not necessarily a huge difference. So I don't want anybody to think that I said, oh, my God, it was a huge difference between the two populations. But given a host of factors, okay, we're going to, you know, those factors being things like income, being education, being exposure to other chemicals such as lead, you know, and other sorts of socioeconomic factors that we know to affect, you know, children's ability to perform in this country. That 5-point difference that early on can become a huge difference in the next generation, in the following generation, and in the generation after that. You see what I'm saying, Kim?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So it's not necessarily that the exposure itself is going to create a gap in achievement, but it is a factor when compounded with other factors could be significant. So,
interesting.
I don't know if did I say that you know,
yes,
simply enough, so I don't want to. Okay. So but yeah, so that was one that's just one example. Now the European group, I should say, had a few things going on that may also help, you know, contribute to that 5-point deficit. And one of those things was, I think, prenatal care and also good access to early childhood education in preschool. So there are things that, you know, an enriched environment can also kind of offset some of these, you know, these factors that might be related to reducing IQ or impacting the performance of minority children. And,
exactly.
You know, and we can talk about that on the future show, or how the importance of early education and early enrichment and what we can do to improve, you know, our minority children's, you know, chances of success. So, you know, this is why these sorts of things are, why environmental justice to me is important.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. And, you know, it's my belief, my personal belief, that if we, you know, there are a lot of issues that we need to tackle, but this is one of the major issues that we need to tackle in order to kind of clean up, you know, number one, the inner cities, but also to clean our bodies and to clean our minds and to give, you know, these children, you know, a better future. We have to clean up their environment, but along with that comes a lot of education. So, you know, again, with the urban gardens, all of that, I mean, here in Chicago, they've taken on an endeavor which is admirable to me, because, you know, we have a lot of food deserts here. And what they've done is they've taken old school buses and converted them and refrigerated them. And they go to the, you know, urban areas and they sell fresh fruits and vegetables. You know, now what I would like to see in some of these urban areas, and this is just me, is I would like to see cooperatives. Whereas, you know, a lot of those vacant lots, turn them into farmland if that can be done. You know, if in the city of Chicago, I think they can own chickens, you know, chicken coop, you know, with the fresh eggs and all of that, and sell it at the co-op at a discount. You know, people buy into the co-op, you know, buy shares into it, and then they're able to get...
Well, yeah, they have CSAs in some cities, too, you know, just so you guys know. You know, community-based agriculture, you know, and, you know, sometimes you can buy, you know, a decent amount of fruit, of fresh fruits and vegetables for a reasonable price. I mean, I know I had a CSA you know, a few months ago, and I bought into a CSA a few months ago. Sometimes you have to buy in upfront.
Exactly.
Sometimes they'll just let you, you know, buy as you need. But you know, sometimes it's $175. Sometimes it's more. But when you really think about the cost versus of the CSA, and you know, eating out or you know, going to the grocery store, in a lot of ways, you could actually save a lot of money going with the CSA. If you really use what they give you, and sometimes they even give you like recipe cards and. And I know that there are a lot of, urban, associations and communities that actually work with, you know, rural farmers to actually bring these to people
mm-hmm.
in lower income neighborhoods.
Exactly.
More could be done.
Exactly.
But,
I have a bunch of great ideas for that, but, you know, I'm not going to put them out on the radio. I'm going to write this out and try to see if we can get up some fresh. I mean, and it's just absolutely phenomenal. But, again, you know, going back to the environmental justice, you know, again, what's the purpose of putting an urban garden, you know, in a particular area if the ground is contaminated? See, we have to do the testing and all of that. First, there are a lot of factors to this particular equation, and that's what we're trying to get people to understand. And that's why we're encouraging people to listen to this show.
Or if the air is particularly, you know, polluted. Because, you know, although, you know, you don't eat the air, you know what I mean? But, you know, things can be deposited onto the plants from the air.
Exactly.
You know?
Right. It's engaged. That's why you need a relationship with the EPA and, you know, the environmental groups, because they have the tools to come out to see, you know, what type of contaminants are in the ground and in the air, and, you know, they can help you.
Right. I mean, and a lot of our cities still, there are some places that still even have leaded pipes. And this is why, why when you're cooking, and I tell everybody that I know this, when you're cooking, do not use hot water for cooking unless you boil it, you know, because when you use the hot water, you can potentially increase the amount of lead because just a basic physics lesson, heat excites atomic activity, okay? It makes things more energetic. So you actually may cause more lead to be present in the water that you're using. If you're trying to cook, you can reduce that by using cold water. And you'll pick up a lot less lead. Just a helpful tip.
And another thing, people, do not hold on to the same sponge for a month or two. Those things, so much nastiness is contained in a sponge.
Well, you know, actually they have, they do actually have the environmentally friendly sponges that can be put in your dishwasher. So look into those.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. So there's that. And going back to what I was saying about, exposure, like the air exposure situation, this is the controversial bit that I was telling you guys before, or getting ready to tell you guys before. There is some research that suggests that living in close proximity to highways or freeways may be a factor, may be a potential factor or a potential risk factor for a child developing autism. And this is important, again,
what
I was saying before, because we spend quite a lot of money on in education and health and other things, trying to deal with developmental disorders and behavioral disorders. And we don't necessarily know the etiology of every single one of these conditions. We know that there are genetic components and there are other things, but there is some idea in the scientific community that a lot of these disorders are the result of gene by environment interactions. So you come with a certain, you know, predisposition, you know, to having a certain disease or a certain disorder, and you get an exposed to certain things, and that might lead to a particular outcome. And that's like the simplest way that I can put it. So, this particular thing is still somewhat controversial, because there's a whole lot of caveats to be made about the study, you know, the studies that this comes from. And it's the, I believe it was, let me see if I can recall. I think I have it pulled up on my computer, because I had to give a presentation on this a long time ago. But it's a huge study in California, and I can't remember the name of it right now. But I'll post it on the Black Freethinker page if I can, you know, remember what it was. But yeah, so there's that. And there are possibly a whole host of other, you know, types of toxic agents that could be in our environment that we haven't, you know, thought of, haven't, you know, noticed yet. You know, they might be toxic, but they're masked by the effects of other toxic substances, or we haven't detected them because they're very low-dose exposures and they're things that accumulate over time and, you know, they're related to other sorts of conditions, so we can't necessarily pair them out. But this was all supposed to sort of be an overview of the issues associated with it. And so I encourage you all to go out and look for, you know, the resources. You know, the EPA has some resources on this. The Department of the Interior has some resources. You know, there are, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus has done some work in this area. Former Senator Clyburn, I think. He's done work in this area. You can look up Robert Bullard. Again, he's the father of the environmental justice movement, and he has a series of books, and I need to catch up on some reading, for real. Because he has some really, really interesting titles, and hopefully, you know, I'll be able to, you know, read those and kind of give you guys some more information. I'm still sort of a baby to this environmental justice thing myself. I've studied toxicology a little bit, and I'm familiar with it. I do know that there are some issues within it, the environmental justice movement, really environmentalism in general, that could, I think, benefit from skeptical voices, because there are some within the community who kind of have some very unscientific or illogical sorts of beliefs about the environment and what have you. And you know, those sorts of issues sometimes can cloud our judgment and keep us from seeing the bigger picture. There's no way that we can avoid toxic substances altogether. There's no way. We can't do it. It's not possible. You know, because, again, everything is a potential poison. So we have to be reasonable and try to, you know, reduce our risk whenever possible. You know, if you work in an industry that uses a lot of toxic substances, make sure that you use your gear properly. Use your respirators. Use the armor of God that some people have to use. You know, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, sometimes you have to cover yourself from head to toe. Some people get very lax in their jobs. You know. And they think, oh, I've done this for years, I haven't had a problem. And they decide, oh, I'm just going to leave my respirator off today. No. You have to be responsible, too. And you have to keep these sorts of things in mind. There was a there was an incident at a coke plant in Tennessee not that long ago, and I think they're still I don't even think they've actually gone to court yet. They're probably still doing the research and what have you from that. But they had a coke plant, and they had a the place where they kept the coal and sort of byproducts of the coal for the plant. It had the building had collapsed, or something had happened to it. I think it was actually following an earthquake, and a lot of the material within the building had actually run into a river, a major river that is actually a source of water and food for a lot of the people in that area. There have been in the past, dry cleaners. There's been several incidents of this all over the country where dry cleaners have improperly disposed of chemicals associated with dry cleaning, and people found out later when their children had birth defects, or when pets died or what have you, or when they couldn't grow grass even,
right.
There's been improper disposal of hazardous waste and nuclear material by our own government.
Exactly.
So and some of these things are, and I don't want you guys to think that like all of these things are like, there's conspiracy necessarily.
Right.
What I mean? With all of these things. Sometimes, there are conspiracies to cover these things up, but sometimes we really don't always know. I mean, a lot of the ways that we found out that things were toxic were because somebody disposed of something in a way that everyone believed was okay. And then we found out 10, 20, 30 years later. Oops.
Exactly.
You know?
I actually have a question for you.
Yeah.
Me personally. Now, you were talking about the dry cleaners. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. And you were talking about the dry cleaners and how they were dumping their chemicals and all of that. Someone told me something a while ago, and I didn't really take stock in it because of who said it to me, so I decided I'm going to ask you today. You know the plastic covering that they use at the dry cleaners for your clothing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does it contain contaminants? I'm not quite sure how. You may know or you may not know, but someone to my attention.
I've heard people say that before, and I've never actually researched it. So if you will remind me, I will actually research it, and I will give you the answer on a future show.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
But I know what you're talking about, I don't tell you guys these things to make you paranoid. You know what I mean? Because again, you cannot necessarily avoid all of these things. Part of, particularly if you like the way that we live in the modern world, you know what I mean? You're going to get some exposure to something at some point in time. And, I just want your eyes to be open, to the idea that, you can sometimes limit or reduce your risk by taking certain steps, So I hope I haven't like given anyone a complex today.
Exactly. And I brought it up because, again, someone had brought it up to me. It was enough to pique my interest, and I didn't do any research on it. So, I'm going to be honest enough to say that. And, I hadn't even really thought about it until we started doing the show, and when you started saying dry cleaning, it just kind of triggered it. And so now that's something that I'm going to have, research as well. So when we do another environmental justice show, we'll be able to present our findings on it. So,
This is just a disclaimer. I am not speaking against the dry cleaning industry as a whole.
Not
disparaging them. I'm not telling you that they're horrible people and they just want to dump waste in your backyard and collect your money.
We never said anything like that. Right, right, right.
yeah. We have not told anyone not to get their clothes dry cleaned. Trust me, you would love to have my dry cleaning bill right there, dry cleaners. You know, but you know, again, it was just, you know, it's not, you know, we're not disparaging, you know, that particular profession. We're just saying that we want people to be informed, and if possible, we can make that environment a lot healthier for everyone because, you know, not only the people that, you know, take their clothes to the dry cleaners, but what about the people that work there? So we're looking at it, you know, as all-encompassing.
Right. Exactly. You know, and then there are some, I mean, and then also, and I just want to, you know, kind of in the last like 30 minutes here, you know, kind of talk about sort of the other side, you know, or another side of the environmental justice issue, which are interests. So sometimes, you know, like, you know, how do I put this? You know, sometimes it might be in the interest of a community, you know, in terms of economics. You know, there are sometimes, like, they want a power company or someone else will want to put a coal plant or something else, some other kind of manufacturing plant in a particular neighborhood. And knowing how economically depressed a lot of areas are, the risk that is associated with the pollution or the exposure may not be as bad as the potential economic, you know, fallout of not, you know, deciding to allow those companies to come in. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because, you know, in some cases, the jobs might be more important than the environmental exposure.
You're right, but see, the bad side, the downside to that is, you know, again, with the Affordable Care Act, you know, hopefully that will change some things and change some habits of some people, but, you know, even the people that get the jobs there and they feel that the income outweighs the potential, you know, environmental issues, you know, when their body starts to fail or start having issues, many of these same people, they can't, you know, they can't take the time off. They can't afford to go to the
doctor. No, and I'm not arguing against that, Kim. I'm just saying that there are times where one has to also consider other interests beyond the potential toxic effects of being exposed. So sometimes these communities, particularly where there's not a whole lot of economic development and there's not a whole lot of education or access, you know, it may be reasonable to have a plant come in, you know what I mean?
Right.
See, and maybe, it may be our role in that case will be make working with the company or the community to make sure that, you know, that strict regulations are followed or that, you know, proper use of, you know, of occupational, you know, protective gear is being used, or that we improve the education system in the area or access to health care. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I understand, and I kind of agree with that, but, you know, I even want to take it a step beyond that. We have industrial parks. Put all of those in there. Increase and, you know, improve public transportation to get these people to their places of employment on time, you know.
And you know what, that could be another one of the things that I'm saying that we add on. I'm just saying that,
ma'am,
I think that it's very easy to get emotional about it, you know what I mean, or to get so concerned about the potential health risks that we don't see the bigger picture. Because these people can be healthy and broke. You know what I mean? And these people can be healthy and broke for a while anyway. Because you know, being broke does not keep you healthy in this country. You know what I mean?
But, exactly.
You know, and there may be a way to maintain the health of an individual in a community where we also have, you know, this a manufacturing plant or sources of pollution there may be ways that we can, and again, like I said, there are other things that you can keep in mind too. Nutrition can help, can be protective, you know,
making
sure that you're exercise, you know, all sorts of things can keep you protected, or offer some protection rather from these sorts of exposures. So you have to keep all of these, you have to think holistically is my point, you know?
Right.
It's not always, industry bad, you know, we must keep them out, you know, it's like, you know, there might be a situation where we as compassionate, you know, caring environmentalists and environmental justice advocates will want to go into a community and protect them from the battle of industry people, you know what I mean? And
mm-hmm.
those people want the jobs. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So we can't necessarily
exactly.
make the decision for them, but we can only
right.
we can only try to inform them and say, okay, understanding that you want these jobs, let me tell you what the potential risks are. And let me see if
exactly.
I can work with you and work with this other party and try to figure out ways that we can improve the situation for you should you be at risk.
Right, they
you know?
Have a choice. They'll be informed
right.
and they'll have a choice. But, you know,
right.
like I said, you know, with improving, you know, the public transportation and improving the roads for those that choose to drive to work, you know, is, you know, I just, you know, I have mixed feelings about that. Yes, we need the jobs,
yeah.
but, you know, what's more important, the job or your health? Because, you know, but, yeah, you got to be able to pay your bills. So it's, you know, I'm kind of mixed on that. I need to do a little bit more research.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult area. It is an area where we have to use more than just our emotions and more than just our science, and you know, we
mm-hmm.
have to use more than just our logic. Sometimes we have to think about our ethics. You know what I mean? Sometimes we have to think about the needs and desires of the people on the ground, because they may not always see things the way that we see them. They might be willing to take the risk of, you know, lung cancer after 20 or 30 years of work at, you know, plant B. You know what
right.
I mean?
Exactly.
And as long as and if they have, as long as their child has access to good education, or if they're able perhaps to have a good pension, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or
right.
or a good salary, you know? Sometimes
mm-hmm.
I mean sometimes in these Appalachian towns, you know, where the men, you know, work at the coal mine, you know, it's a detriment to their health in the long term, but they're able to do more for their children.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
And in
That's
some cases they're
true.
Able to support an entire family on one income.
Exactly.
You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly.
So
and, you know,
it's there are trade-offs, you know? It's, and nothing is black and white, you know?
Right. That is true. But, you know, it still saddens me. And one of the reasons why is because, you know, in some cases these companies and the government knew what the effects were, but they neglected
mm-hmm.
to tell the people. And I guess, you know, one of my issues, you know, just in life, period, is I don't feel that you should take somebody's options away. And
no,
you should,
no.
you know, yeah, neglect to tell them the information. Now, whether they decide to stay and to continue on, that's, you know, their choice. But, you know, a lot of this information is coming out. You know, we've seen these massive class action lawsuits, and, you know, they're cleaning it up. And, you know, even with, you know, the EPA now, they're making some changes, not as quickly as, you know, I would like to see, but, you know, slowly but surely.
Yeah, and again, we have to keep in mind that the EPA can only work within the bounds of the law, and if we don't have the right laws, they can't do their job, you know, and there's been some resistance on, you know, on the part of, you know, certain people in certain parties, shall we say, you know, on both, and really on both sides to a certain degree, but not as much on one side as the other, but, you know, resistance to science. And the, you know, the scientific wisdom on things like climate change, which has been shown to have you know, differential effects on people in the third world versus the first world, and on people within the first world based on income, you know. we're getting to a point now where the climate is so volatile, where food, in some sense, is a luxury. You know?
Right.
And
yeah.
And it's unfortunate, and we have to think holistically about the solutions that we're gonna put forth for how to deal with things like food sustainability and food security. You know, we have to think, you know, more than just organic food. You know, we have
exactly.
We're over 7 billion people in the world right now. Over 7 billion. They're saying we may reach 15 billion. Within a few decades. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
We have got to think, you know, holistically. You know, it means making some tough decisions and thinking about things in ways that may make us uncomfortable, because we're going to have to figure out ways to feed those people.
Exactly. Exactly.
And we're going to have to think about perhaps not having so many children. And we're going to have to think about a lot of different things, you know. And it's going
exactly.
to make some of us very uncomfortable to do that. But if we don't do it, we're going to put ourselves in a bad spot.
Exactly. 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 And so, you know, that gives us something to aspire for. But in addition to that, again, it's about education. We want you all to go out there and educate yourselves, and we hope that we've piqued your interest to the point that you're willing to go out and look at, you know, at least a couple of the things that we talked about today. I've posted some links. I know Raina is going to post, you know, many, many more links. And, you know, again, you know, we're bringing these shows to educate you all as to the history of, you know, in this case, environmental justice, where it is now and, you know, where we hope that it will go in the future. But, you know, again, this does directly affect you. You know, it affects the price of food. Again, you know, we haven't even talked about water reclamation yet, you know, just in depth, you know, as far as, you know, environmental justice is concerned. But
yeah. And water is a major issue, too. I mean, water is precious, you know. We only have so much water in the world. And if we poison our water supplies, that's, you know, our fresh water supplies, we're screwed. Because it you know, and people think of the world is made up of mostly water. But yeah, most of that water we can't drink. It's salt water. And it takes
exactly.
a lot of energy to make salt water drinkable. So
exactly.
we can't so salt water is not an option. We have to protect
exactly.
our fresh water resources.
Exactly. And, you know, I said water reclamation. For those that aren't familiar, reclamation means the act or process of reclaiming or a restoration as to productivity, usefulness, or morality. So, again, how we process the water, how we purify it, how we recycle it.
Right. Yep. So... And we didn't even talk about like water fluoridation and everything, and some people think of that as an environmental justice issue. Okay, knowing the science, it's not an environmental justice issue. Sorry, there's a lot of research that demonstrates the safety of water fluoridation and its effects on health and its protective effects, particularly on dental health. And the only issue, if one wants to me. To discuss, you know, the water fluoridation is the ethics of medicating people without their permission. that is the only conversation that I will entertain regarding water fluoridation, because it is not to me a matter of whether it is safe or whether it is healthy, but if you wanted to bring up the ethics of doing that, I think I have a good argument for why we're doing it and why it is necessary. But I would be willing to listen to somebody who disagreed and felt that was, you know, medicating people without consent.
Yeah. Right. And you know, I challenge, you know, the listeners, please do a Google search on water prescription drugs. And you can, you know, just water and prescription drugs and, you know, just look at it, tap water and prescription drugs and studies, and
right.
you'll be surprised.
Right. Well, I hope that everybody was entertained and kind of learned something. So, I am, like I said, I could have gone into a lot of different other things, and, you know, I just didn't want to overwhelm anybody or, you know, kind of, you know, start going off into, because Kim knows me. Kim knows me. If I start talking about certain things, I go into, you know, Raina nerd mode, Raina science mode, and, like, I can start, you know, using terms and talking over people's heads, and I don't necessarily want to do that. I want people to be able to follow me. I want to talk about things that most people can understand, even if they don't have a scientific background.
Exactly, and that's why we're bringing these shows to you, because we're, you know, trying to basically interpret it in terms that everybody can understand. Because one of the issues is with a lot of these politicians is they'll talk over people's heads in the hope that you don't go back and research and that you don't understand what they're saying.
Well, here's the other problem, Kim. A lot of them don't even know the science themselves. They don't.
Exactly.
They're not intelligent. They're not educated. Some of them don't even want to know. I mean, you know, this is one of the issues that, you know, that we need to talk about in our American politics. We are a nation that is governed by lawyers, and this
exactly.
is not always the case. You know, there were at least 5 doctors that signed the Declaration of Independence. You know,
exactly.
And
exactly.
and right now, I think there is one scientist or one person with a scientific background in Congress, and one with an engineering background. And this is probably why we have a crumbling infrastructure and we're falling behind in science and math.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why equip people with the information. We want to equip you with the information, equip you with the knowledge, because, again, knowledge is power. And so when you have these people, and in like, you know, like Raina just said, you know, most of them do not have the background or the knowledge, you know, of what they're talking about, and what they're doing is,
I mean,
they have
Kim, uh-huh. the guy who's in charge of like the Committee on Science Education,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't believe in evolution.
Right.
He's not accepting the fact of evolution. Like, how is this possible?
Exactly. Exactly.
How are you on the House Science Committee and you don't know that evolution is a fact?
Exactly.
That should be like the first criterion. Accept
exactly.
gravity, accept evolution. Those
mm-hmm.
two things.
Exactly, and that's the reason why we're trying to get you all the information, because, you know, it's like being able to go to one of those people, ask a question that you know they don't have the answer to, and just sit there and, you know, crickets and tumbleweeds, you know, just see like the deer caught in headlights one, because they can't answer the question. And if you ask it even in the most basic form, It lets you and everyone else know that this person doesn't know what they're talking about. But a lot, again, many of them are recapitulating talking points. They don't know what they're talking mm-hmm. about. Somebody writes a script, sends them the memo. They read it, they memorize it, and, you know, again, they plant their people to ask certain questions that they can answer. And they don't even really have a real answer. They have a form answer. If you notice, with many of these people, they're all giving the same answers. You know, it's a script.
Right. Before we get gone, guys, I want you guys to, if you get a chance, take a look at my blog that I wrote last year about environmental justice as a skeptical platform that has some really good resources in it, things that I didn't get to talk about today. But you know how this goes, guys. You know, we get off on different, you know, different topics and different discussions. We try to keep it fluid and you know, take it wherever it goes. So you guys can take a look at that. That'll give you some resources that you can look into. Again, I will post some more. And this is not the last show that we'll be doing on, you know, environmental justice. Hopefully I'll be able to get some people from some different you know, environmental justice groups onto the show. And I hope that you guys enjoy your weekend. Please participate in the National Day of Solidarity if you get an opportunity. You know, and, you know, think about these sorts of issues and think about what you can do in your own community or, you know, or in your own life or, you know, to kind of help people understand what you've just learned or to help protect others, you know, or inform others. You know, if there's an environmental justice group in your city, you know, maybe consider going to some meetings, maybe help out, pass out information, you know, and show your support.
Right, exactly. So this is for you. You know, we're telling you these things for you, for your edification, for your growth, and for your evolvement, you know, as a person, regardless of your ideology. You know, this information is out there for everyone. And, again, we're trying to break it down in terms that, you know, everyone can understand. And, you know, we're here for questions. You know, Raina's information is out there. Tell them how to contact you, Raina.
You can hit me on my blog, you know, Roads to Reality on WordPress. My email address is roads2reality@gmail.com. For the spelling of my name is RHOADES. and you can contact me on my blog or on my email address, ask me questions. If you can't reach me directly, you can also get in contact with me through Kim or the Black Freethinkers page. You know, I also have a couple Facebook pages. I have one for my blog and one for my show, so there's the RSS feed, you know, Facebook page, and then there's the Roads to Reality blog page. So tell your friends, you know, talk about environmental justice with your friends. You know, see what they might know. See what stories they might be familiar with, you know.
Exactly. And you guys will be hearing a lot more from Raina in the future because congratulations are
in order.
Wait,
they didn't announce it yet. We got to keep
right.
it on the low key.
Okay. All right.
We
got to
keep
it on the low right now. Damn it anyway.
Low.
Okay, this is a pre.
You about to blow everything.
No, it's all good. It's all good. But no, you all, you know, just phenomenal. There's a lot coming, guys. There's a lot coming down the pipe here, and you know, we're just proud of our Raina. We are.
Aww.
I want to let you know that
Thank
we're
you.
Proud of you.
Thank you, honey. I appreciate it.
You
know, I do, and guys, I just want to let you guys know that, like, we do this stuff. We don't do this for, like, celebrity or, like, you know, people to, you know, make us to make us feel popular or anything like this. I really only do this because I like talking about these issues and I like helping to inform folks. And you know, we don't make any money from this. We're not trying to make any money from this. This is a labor of passion, you know, something that we feel, you know, strongly about. And that is educating people and helping people to think better and to live better and to, you know, to get active
exactly.
and to get involved. And, you know, so if you guys want to support us, please support us. Like, you know, you can send us emails, you can send us money, because sometimes it takes money to actually research these topics. You know, you can offer your services. You know, if you know something or if you have something that you feel that you can bring to the table, let us know. Tell us what you're doing and we'll support you. You know, we're here to support each other.
Exactly, and that's, you know, what this forum is for, is supporting, you know, one another, and, you know, exactly, you know, trust me, there is no money to be made in this. Okay, and, you know,
like none.
If it is, we haven't figured
like,
it out yet, but, you know,
in fact, sometimes we might lose money, you know what I mean, but we don't mind, like, we do it because we like doing it, this is something we
exactly.
like to do, and so, you know, if you guys like what we do, if you really appreciate it, you know, please show us, you know, because sometimes it gets hard, you know, you don't know how you affect other people until they tell you, and, you know, And
exactly.
You know, and the more, you know, support we have, and the more you know, funds that we have, the more we can do together as a group. You know.
Exactly, because it's a lot of ideas, you know, we toss stuff around. It's a lot of things that we want to do. And, you know, some of these ideas, you know, it takes money. It takes money and, you
and
know.
It takes, and it takes bodies. It takes, you know,
yes.
resources, you know.
Yes.
It takes people. Yes. It takes people who have, you know, skills in graphic design, and people who have skills in advertising, and people who have, you know, oratory skills. And people, you know, it's just all sorts. So if you have any of these talents and you want to help us and you want to kind of further our cause, you know, let us know.
Exactly. And it takes bodies. And so, you know, my last appeal is please support your local groups. Tomorrow for the Day of Solidarity, I put in the chat room earlier. I'll put it in the chat room again. I'll post it on my Facebook wall and post it. Well, I've already posted it on the Day of Solidarity.
Can we have someone who wants to donate? Please let them know how to donate, too.
Yeah. You know, like I said, support the local groups. They're all over the country. If you want to donate to Black Nonbelievers of Chicago, you can send us a donation via PayPal at donate@blacknonbelieversofchicago.org. Again, donate@blacknonbelieversofchicago.org. And you can send donations in that way. But the local groups, there are many of them. You know, you have one in Atlanta, a couple of them in New York, Sacramento, Philadelphia, Chicago here, of course, Kansas City, Missouri, D.C., you know, all over the place. And, Orlando. Can't forget those guys down there, Sacramento, Los Angeles. Please, you know, let us know. Reach out. As a matter of fact, there's an ongoing donation drive for the Black Skeptics of Los Angeles. They are giving away four $1,000 scholarships to LGBT children that have come from difficult situations, whether it was homeless or foster care, and they're giving them, you know, those scholarships to help them for college. You know, $1,000 goes a long way when you're in school, and we want them to give more scholarships away next year, so it's an ongoing fundraiser. So please, if you're going to donate some money to, you know, a cause that, you know, I think is truly worthy, that's one, because I feel that the education of these children, you know, people that have been disenfranchised in one way or the other, it's important that we support them and that we support one another in these endeavors, you know, that we actually see get up off the ground, but most importantly, that are helping others. See, that's what I'm about. I'm about helping other people. It's not about
that's
me.
Right.
It's always been about you.
That's right. Well, thank you so much, guys. I hope you have a great day of solidarity and enjoy the rest of your weekend. You know, thank you for listening.
And thank you for your time. You know, thank you for your time. And 2 weeks from now, Raina will be back and, you know, with more fantastic information.
Sorry, I'm not better with announcing these things ahead of time, guys. Like, you know, I'm trying to get a lot of things together. I have a lot of things going on right now. In case you guys didn't see, almost a couple weeks ago now, I posted an article called Ain't I a Skeptic? It got a lot of attention on, on various websites, and it's gotten a really nice response from a lot of, I've gotten a really nice response from a lot of people. People seem to like that article. I have another one that I'm going to be putting out shortly, having to do with Black women and stereotypes and shaming, related somewhat to all of these videos that come out where, you know, Black women are being battered and, beaten in these videos and, you know, being called hood rats. And you've seen them. They're on World Star Hip Hop. It's ridiculous. But in any case, check that out. Watch out for that. And thanks again, guys. We only have like a minute left, so I'll let Kim take it, and then you guys the next thing you hear will be the Black Freethinkers theme. So.
All right, guys. Hey, have a lovely weekend. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys this weekend. Peace, love, And we care about you so much. That's why we're here. Take care.
Black free thinkers, where we walk by sight with a bright flashlight to illuminate night. Free thought, we don't walk by faith in the lost mind state, cause it's not quite safe. We don't recruit, we're not peers from a church, so don't be spooked, we're not here to convert. The only truth that's not pulled from a text, show me proof that's not good after death. This is the challenge to think for yourself, break it out of the bottle and speak what you felt. 310-982-4273 to get through.